I don't know how anyone can like it, but they do. You know, Marmite is one of those polarizing things, isn't it? You either love it or, if you've got any taste, you hate it. And they've used that idea in their advertising for years. Spread love, not hate, they say. Well, if you think you're spreading love, spread it on your piece of bread, not mine. And now they've made it even worse. They've introduced Marmite peanut butter. Can you think of anything worse? Smothered on a warm crumpet, they say, spread generously on a slice of sourdough, simply scoffed straight from the jar. This delicious new flavor creation is set to be a hit. If you're already a fan of Marmite or peanut butter, the unique combination of flavors is sure to set your world on fire. And then it finishes off, even if you're a hater, remember that two wrongs can sometimes make a right. So take the plunge and give it a try. Two wrongs can sometimes make a right. I don't know where we're going. Look, the best thing about this is you've got two awful tastes in one jar. Keep them locked in there. That's all I can advise. Now, you say, we didn't come to church to learn about Marmite. And you didn't. But this chapter is a great Marmite chapter. There are people loving and hating the same thing, the same person. God's anointed king is the Marmite Messiah. If you like, you love him or you hate him. It's a less well-known chapter than last week's and all the fun of David and Goliath, but the story continues to teach us about ourselves and to teach us about our God. So here's its first lesson. The Lord divides. David is the focus of the chapter, at the heart of the loving and the hating. He is God's anointed one, God's anointed king, though it's hard to know who's aware of that at this stage. And Saul is wearing the crown still. He's the current king, but he knows the Lord's rejected him. And Saul, along with all the army, has watched David, the shepherd boy, do what the king should have done himself. Take on the giant Philistine champion Goliath and win the victory that has now given its name to any lopsided contest. Oh, it's a case of David v. Goliath. And this chapter's full of the reactions to him. And they love him, and they love him, and they love him, and he hates him. And the first character in the frame is Saul's son, Jonathan. Jonathan loves David. That's the opening paragraph to the chapter. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, literally his soul knit with David's, and he loved him as himself. And that phrase is repeated again at the end of verse 3. He loved him as himself. Now, some people in recent years have picked up on it and pointed to David and Jonathan as an example of a sexually active homosexual relationship. It's unlikely. The Bible consistently speaks against those relationships, and if this were an example of them, you'd expect the author either to explain why it's good or to expose it as wrong. I mean, he doesn't spare David's blushes when it comes to adultery with Bathsheba, does he? I don't think he's speaking into that situation at all. What it definitely does speak of is the reality and value there can be in a deep and meaningful same-sex friendship. The kind of friendship you often come across in sports teams, in the military, well, in all walks of life, to be honest. Enjoy it. Treasure it. And David's now a permanent member of the royal household, verse 2, and Jonathan formalizes their friendship. He doesn't just leave it to good chemistry between them. Verse 3, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And what he does next would have sent shockwaves through the social media of the day. Look at verse 4. Jonathan then took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David along with his tunic. Now, this is far more than just, you know, put this round you, David, don't get cold. Jonathan is the crown prince. He's the heir to the throne. These are our robes of office. And it's not a couple of teenagers playing around. Jonathan is some 25 years David senior, and he strips himself of his rank and he says, David, you should be king. He even gives him his sword, his bow, and his belt. And remember, until David arrived on the scene, Jonathan was the hero. He had so much to lose, and yet he takes off the trappings of power and bows the knee to David, to God's anointed king, and says, the crown belongs with you. It's remarkable. I don't know how that went down in the palace, but we'll see it's a humbling contrast to what we'll see from his father. Jonathan loves David. The army loves David. Verse 5. Whatever mission Saul sent him on, David was so successful that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. And this pleased all the troops and Saul's officers as well. Well, everyone loves a winner. And the army took to him. And in a nation full of tribal loyalties and factions and tensions, it's always useful to have the military supporting you. Jonathan, the army, the women love David. Look at verses 6 and 7. It's all part of the victory parade. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with timbrels and lyres. They may not have been at the battle, but it was deciding their future too. A Philistine victory, and everything could have been very different for them. The sense of relief and joy is huge. So verse 7, as they danced, they sang. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands. It's a hit single. Girls Aloud top the charts again. Jonathan loved David. The army loves David. The women love David. Saul hates David. Verse 8, Saul was very angry. And we'll see in a moment how that anger plays out. Saul's out of step with everyone else. He can only see threat. Look, verse 8, this refrain displeased him greatly. They've credited David with tens of thousands, he thought, but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom? See how Saul's mindset's going? I've lost my place as number one already. I'll lose the crown and the kingdom next. Saul's a great reminder that God's anointed one, God's king, will always divide. You love him or you hate him. See, the anointed one means that there is a position taken and a position we often want to occupy for ourselves. Here it's David, who will be king. In the bigger story, of which this is just a part, it's Jesus who is God's anointed king. Either way, he divides. We either embrace him like Jonathan or resist him like Saul. I either see him as my rightful king and rescuer, the one worth abdicating in favor of and following, or I see him as a threat to my kingdom, my pleasures, my worth. I love him or I hate him. He's a Marmite king. But this King Jesus determines my destiny. And actually, it's often in the practicalities of life that you see it worked out. It may be over relationships or some work ethic or money management. The tug of war may go on in our own consciences or the privacy of a conversation with a friend or a minister even. I've talked with people in my office and they've spoken as if they're battling me and battling over a particular issue when the real battle is, will they have Jesus as king, the anointed one as Lord? Remember, Jesus said once, I've come to turn a man against his father. Jonathan would have understood. The anointed one is like a Marmite king. You do either embrace him as Jonathan did or resist him like Saul. There'll be families divided here this morning, won't there? some with Jesus as their king and others resisting him. There'll be friendships that have lasted over years but are heading in opposite directions. Don't imagine a Jesus who's so nice we'll all agree. The Lord divides. But secondly, the Lord exposes. And this is an extraordinary chapter. Saul plunges into a downward spiral, and we really watch him disintegrating through the chapter. Insecure leaders can be very damaging. You know, sometimes they just give up and everything descends into chaos, but often they can become very controlling. And one of the tests for a leader is how we handle those who are more gifted than us. If you never face that test, of course, it's a disaster of another kind. Imagine a group restricted to your gifting level, my gifting level alone. The chart-topping song triggers Saul's insecurity. Saul has slain his thousands, David his tens of thousands. I mean, the figures obviously aren't intended to be precise. The lyrics may really be saying, what a great team David and Saul make. But when you're insecure, you're never going to hear them that way. Paranoia and jealousy mean Saul will only hear, David is a threat. So verse 8, Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. Verse 9, and from that time on, Saul kept a close eye, a jealous eye on him. And that jealousy is going to eat away at him. His rejection by the Lord leaves him open to it all. Verse 10, the next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully on Saul. It's the second time we're told that. It's a reminder that when the Spirit of the Lord leaves someone, we're not left in some bland, neutral vacuum. We so often cling to neutralities that don't exist. The word evil here can imply misery as well as wickedness. And Tim Chester writes, so this is less demonic, more a spirit that brings misery. And it certainly brought that for Saul. I mean, Saul is in one of his moods. I'm sure that's what the attendant said as David came through the door to play the music to soothe him. You know, it's a bad one today, David. Well, it was certainly bad enough to mean that David's music wasn't doing much good. Look at verse 10. Saul had a spear in his hand and he hurled it, saying to himself, I'll pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice. I don't know about you, but if I was playing that day, I'd be glad if I wasn't dependent on the sheet music. I want my eye on the spears, not the notes. One commentator wrote here with kind of classic academic scholarly insight, you might say the relationship was deteriorating. I think it's called British understatement. Now, jealousy robs you of the ability to think straight. It eats away at your sense of perspective and your heart. So Saul sends David away to fight battles, but he wins them. Verse 16, all Israel and Judah love David. He offers his older daughter in marriage, verse 17, only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord. For Saul said to himself, I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. Do you see his scheming? Keep David fighting, and sooner or later, the Philistines will get him. It's the law of averages. Saul is not stupid. He is not going to kill the most popular man in the country. But he's already got his press statement ready to be released. The palace is sad to announce the tragic death of General David, a great servant of the nation. He only knows he mustn't press the smug smile emoji to go with it. And next it's his other daughter, Michelle, who was in love with David, verse 20. And Saul is thrilled. Well, who wouldn't be if your daughter's in love with a handsome hero, the heartthrob of the nation? No, don't go there. Look how twisted Saul's heart's become. Verse 21. I will give her to him so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. He's got no concern for his own daughter. He hasn't got a thought for her well-being. He's just happy to use her as bait. The bridal price turns out to be 100 Philistine foreskins. It's okay, I know it's before the 9 o'clock watershed. I won't go into more details. Ask someone wise around you later on. Now, it sounds gory, but actually there's none of the brutality of so much warfare, ancient and modern here. What Saul is really saying is 100 dead Philistines and bring the evidence. And David delivers, and some. You know, he says to his men, he says, well, lads, we might as well kill 200 while we're about it. I mean, she's worth it. So verse 27, David killed 200 Philistines and brought back their foreskins, and they counted out the full number to the king. And I'll leave your imagination to picture that scene. Let me just say, it is not a Bible verse to be used in marriage preparation classes under how to impress future father-in-laws. In fact, this father-in-law is more frightened than impressed. His jealous heart is sickening all the time in this chapter. See, in verse 8, he's very angry. In verse 9, he's going to keep a close, jealous eye on David. In verse 12, he's afraid. In verse 15, he's afraid again. In verse 29, he became still more afraid of David. And he remained his enemy the rest of his days. Well, if that's what's going on here, we shouldn't really be surprised when that greater Messiah King, Jesus, steps onto the page of human history and we read in the Gospels, they plotted to kill Jesus. There have always been people who hate the king, whose eyes are so fixed on their kingdom and their throne and their status, they can't bear the idea of God putting another king in their place. My colleague Ricky Tice said to me this week, he said, jealousy, Hugh, it's the sin that's hard to name. I tried to think over that. I think he's probably right. I mean, few of us are any good at naming our sins, not if you ask us to be specific. We can do the general, I'm a sinner. And if we've kind of got to, we'll sort of drag out a lie or two, because everyone's told some kind of lie, and we're probably stealing, we can own up to, because someone's nicked things one way or another. Or honouring mother and father, well, who's been a child and kept that command? Coveting, even I can face bringing that up. You know, I want what is not mine. But you see, jealousy goes further. Jealousy is I want what is not mine, and I want you out of what is rightfully yours. That's much harder to admit to. And yet it happens all the time, doesn't it? You know, it happens at home. Do you have the sibling who was more successful, seemed more liked or more loved? Now, if you did, you probably understand sibling jealousy. If you were the one that was more successful, liked and loved, you probably saw it in your brother and sister. What about the work colleague who you now realize is a work rival as they got the promotion you were longing for? Saul will certainly do anything to get David out of his life, and I wonder if we've faced our jealousy where we've needed to. I want to run my own life. I don't want Jesus having authority over me. I want to be my own king. I want the crown. It's one of life's ironies that my insecurities are only truly met when Jesus does wear the crown in my life. When I can take the value and worth he gives me, the Messiah who thought I was worth, you were worth, dying on a cross for. There is no threat that can devalue that. The Messiah who called me for his purposes and will direct all our gifts, big and small, to that calling. I need your gift. I know it's tiny. I need it over there, under that, because it's key to the purpose I've got. There's no threat that can devalue that either. Yet Saul's life only shrivels in this chapter. His world narrows to keep him at the center. His vision shrinks to disregard everyone for the sake of removing his fear. His wisdom is lost in his sense of threat. Saul remained David's enemy the rest of his days. The Lord divides and the Lord exposes. And pray God, he does not need to treat us with the strong medicine Saul received. Here's one other truth about the Lord in this chapter. The Lord protects. Do you notice all the way through the chapter, the Lord protects his anointed one. With all these attempts on his life, David is kept safe. Actually, he doesn't even know the danger he's in from Saul at the moment, though that's going to come in the next chapters. But it comes to nothing. The crown will land up on David's head. By the law of averages, one of his campaigns must end in disaster, but the law of averages never seems to work for Saul. Instead, success followed success for David. His popularity kept him at the top of the charts, and the chapter ends, verse 30. David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. Strangely enough, Saul knew why it was all happening like this. See, look back to verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David, but had departed from Saul. Or at the other end of the chapter, verse 28, Saul realized the Lord was with David. It's a picture that's true for God's big story as well as for this particular one. God's purposes are constantly opposed. God's anointed king is constantly opposed. God's purposes are constantly opposed, but God's purposes cannot be stopped. Even when they crucify Jesus, death can't hold him. God does raise him, as Peter explains at Pentecost. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah. We can unite in hatred. We can form unholy alliances. We can be political and religious leaders clubbing together. We can be the governor appointed by the occupying powers, Pilate, and the native warlord King Herod. But actually, when we club together, they did what your power and will had decided beforehand should happen. The cross that rescues us, that forgives us our jealousies and rebellions. When it comes to the crown, there's only ever going to be one winner, God's king. The Lord protects. And how we respond can't change that. But we have to respond, and respond in a world full of those who stand against Jesus. Love or hate? How do you respond? You want to look for a more neutral word? Well, there are only two paths. They can look similar at times. They can be very close at times, but they lead in one or other of these two directions. He is the Marmite king. You love him or you hate him. You pray that your love would deepen. You pray you can bow the knee to God's king and ask for a heart to love and not hate. Where are you heading?